Hello and welcome to Jeanette's TV. I'm your host, Jeanette Burke. We are live on location at the Meridian Hall, formerly the Sony Center in Toronto, for the Elevate Tech Conference. And what a conference this is. Jam-packed full of speakers, different venues. Today we heard from Chris Hadfield, who is a former astronaut, and we're soon going to be hearing from Martha Stewart about how to cook with cannabis. There's a lot more coming, and we're so happy to bring it to you, so please stay with us.
CYA, like how I could get a good job if it failed, and how if I couldn't raise money, I could go back and, you know, we'll go back and work at Salesforce. So luckily she got on board, and it's kind of a funny story to tell now, but at the time it was, you know, completely stressful and scary. But
so how much tougher was that conversation than raising your seed in Series A?
It was harder. Yeah, we started right in the financial crisis, 2000, right after the financial, so 2009, at the beginning of 2009. So I didn't really realize it at the time, but all of the venture capitalists we went and talked to were, they were pretty cold on our idea and what we were doing. And what I didn't really realize at the time that it was, they were pretty worried about their own funds and surviving themselves, because all of their LPs were worried about, were their assets going to be frozen in failing banks? And so it was a pretty difficult time to be raising money, but we persevered.
So I do want to talk, sort of get into the weeds on fundraising. But I guess just one more thing when you think about transitioning from a big company.
Yeah, I never answered your question about the lessons.
Right. Well, I'll weave that into this next one, which is, you know, assuming some people in the audience are in this position right now, have a good job, but have this idea, this sort of burning idea. When you look back, are there things that you were doing, like real things you were watching inside Salesforce and PeopleSoft that you did that helped you, or things that you wished you, like, wow, I wish I took more stock of this specific thing, or
It's a good question. I think that you're gonna learn, I think every experience you have can prepare you to start a company or be an entrepreneur, or you can learn from everything. In my particular case, I learned a lot about how technologies evolve and, you know, what makes a company kind of competitive, seeing the competitive dynamics of PeopleSoft and then the competitive dynamics of Salesforce. I learned all of that. But I would say the most, the thing that resonated me most were more kind of cultural ideas. I think my company called PeopleSoft, the company felt like it was the employee's company. And that was probably what I remember most about it. And the founder of PeopleSoft, a man by the name of Dave Duffield, who was also went on to be the founder of Workday. And so he's had tons of success as a founder and a CEO. But the culture at PeopleSoft was really designed to make it feel like the employees owned it, and they were empowered to make decisions. And that was super motivating for me. And I've tried to, as best possible, replicate that inside of Okta. And I think Salesforce was different, and it was a powerful idea, but in a different way. And that was, and I think you could see it reflected in the previous presentation, because Salesforce is great at being a leading voice and an innovative voice, and that was strong in the Salesforce culture when I was there. At Salesforce, we were creating this new industry, software as a service, no software, and being that leader and being bold and being innovative, that was kind of the cultural ethos of Salesforce. And I would say that was the big takeaway for me there.
So going back to fundraising, let's talk about that. I mean, it was a tough time, as you said. I mean, we're right now in very different times. I mean, it seems like there's just an endless amount of capital, huge interest. But either way, I mean, there are real things, do's and don'ts, things that work in terms of raising early stage capital, pitching to investors. Could you talk through what you learned from that?
I've learned a lot about raising money, and it is a really important step. I mean, it sounds obvious, but some companies can be bootstrapped, but a lot of these companies, you need to raise money to get them going. And it's a little bit of a black art, and you know, the venture capitalists and the investors, they do these deals over and over. You know, they do many deals a month. And as an entrepreneur, as an innovator, you're going to do, you know, maybe a couple deals over 5 years. So you're really at a disadvantage in terms of knowing how the process works and knowing how the normal standards are and so forth. The good news over the last 10 years, I think the whole process has become much more transparent. There's tons of stuff written about it. And I think even when we were fundraising, the industry had gone through 2 or 3 years of a lot more things being documented online. So we knew more about the fundraising process. My co-founder had worked in venture for a summer when he was in MBA school. So the process was more transparent to us. But still, I would just encourage people to really do your homework. And then even that being said, you're still going to be, you know, at a disadvantage given the experience with the VCs you're working with. So keep that in mind. So you might want to, given that disadvantage inherently, you want to make sure you work with people you like and you trust, especially in the early stages. The other thing I would say is that you have to think about when you're pitching your idea to a venture capitalist, you have to really, really play to your strengths. I think that the allure to people is to try to cover every box and say, hey, we check this trend or we're on this technology. But you gotta remember that every pitch they hear, they're probably hearing similar companies tout similar benefits. So the more you can do to pitch, to play to your own strength and express what's unique about you, because everyone does have something unique, some advantage they have, something they know, that's gonna resonate more with being an investor than the generic things that are covered in nearly every pitch they hear. And then for me, it was really, hey, I wanna build this new company, Okta, that's gonna be about security and identity and really an infrastructure layer in the cloud. So what is it about me that could do that? And I really played back on my experience creating or working on Salesforce.com and creating some of the innovative cloud platforms there. And that, you know, that was the one unique thing that I could bring to that conversation that I thought would resonate. And then the last thing I would say is that, and this wasn't natural for me, my natural style is to be more understated and pragmatic, and I'm more of a, like, I'll prove it to you, I'm not just gonna necessarily tell you. But in the fundraising cycle, you really have to amp it up and tell this big story. You know, this vision that may sound crazy when you're two people, you know, in a rented office, in a borrowed office, thinking about this future company you could create. But my co-founder and I, we actually had a PowerPoint deck that was so bad that after a few pitches, we actually, on the encouragement of one investor, we actually got rid of it and just started telling this big story. Because just telling the story directly more accurately conveyed the unique perspective I brought and my co-founder brought, and allowed us to be, I think, bigger and bolder and sell a longer vision, or a longer term, grander vision, than just being constrained by what was expressed in that PowerPoint deck. So it's about that big story. You know, these investors are making, they want to have big returns and big bets, and the bigger story you can, even if you don't even halfway believe it yourself, it's how you have to go. And I think, by the way, it's because of this fact, which is a fact, is why you get a lot of these companies that are just so over the top and so grandiose. It's kind of a result of the system. The system rewards being grandiose and over the top. I think that's, you know, some of the dynamics there.
Just following up on that, in terms of just the big thinking, your first entrepreneur, as you said, you know, these venture capitalists, other investors are doing these deals day in, day out.
Yeah.
There's one negotiating tip you would say, especially when it's your first time, you don't have the track record yet.
Yeah, I think that it sounds simple, but it's super valuable. You have to have competition, and you have to make sure that the other party in the negotiation knows that there's alternatives and there's competition. Not that you want to, you know, do anything disingenuous, but you have to make it a competitive process. It's human nature, right? People act, they have a lot of things they could be doing, they have a lot of things that they could prioritize or not prioritize, and when a deal's competitive, when there's options for the entrepreneur, all things being equal, the investor's gonna act more quickly. I'll give you a concrete example of what I mean, just to not speak in high level kind of ideas. If you are thinking about raising money, and a lot of the temptation, especially for very early entrepreneurs, is they want to go out there and have kind of consultations with and get to know VCs, right, and build a relationship. Not that that's bad, but if you want something to come of those meetings, you have to frame it like you're in a process to raise money, right? Because if you just go meet with someone and you kind of get to know them and pick their brains and get feedback on their idea, and then you kind of want to raise money, you're not going to get that conversation to a conversation about doing a deal without some urgency and some process. So if you frame the conversation up start as, hey, you know, we're raising money, we're going to talk to four or five firms, I'd love to meet you to get to know you a little bit and talk about my idea, you know, can you meet? That's a very different framing than saying, hey, you know, I heard you're this expert in this technology I'm thinking about dabbling in, or this market space I'm thinking about dabbling in, do you want to meet? Very different setups and very different context the investor has to when, you know, they're going to have to be think about kind of jumping into action in terms of the urgency on the other side.
And then I'm moving on to later stage, and then I'd like to get to the IPO, but how, I mean, there you have a track record at that point, you've built something. Where do you go? What do you look for? How do you maximize it? I mean, we've seen clearly these huge valuations being given. We've seen in cases even this week that those don't always end well.
I don't know what you're talking about. Is this a reported thing? I think that, so our early rounds, are the you know, the early rounds of the seed round and then the Series A seemed, you know, it was coming out of the financial crisis, it seemed pretty hard to raise money. The thing I didn't know at the time is that the Series B was going to be harder, much harder. And I think that's because I think a lot of companies run into this, which is, you know, all things being equal, let's say you do your Series B like 3 years after you start a company, 4 years after you start a company. They're not all like that, but let's just say that's approximately. That's the amount of time where you've kind of had the company, you've been building the company long enough to where you probably could be showing a lot of progress. It's like possible. But it's actually not that time to show a ton of progress. So you're kind of stuck in this middle ground. And we had the same issue, and we had, you know, we had a couple customers, but, you know, we weren't the shiny new idea anymore, and we weren't really long enough to get, you know, customer success and sales rolling and revenue rolling, so we're kind of in this middle ground. So Series B was really hard, we got fortunate with building a relationship with some investors that turned out to be really willing to stick by our side and carry us through that. But then after that, the dynamic changed because we got the business running, and that was by the Series C, we got the revenue running, it got to be predictable and growing steadily. So the Series C was really more about, you know, very different than the Series A and the seed round because it was more about the numbers. It was like, yeah, we got this idea, and by the way, we have X customers, and the revenue is, you know, the revenue is Y, and it's growing quickly. It's like, here's the spreadsheet. You know, it's a very different conversation than, hey, here's this big idea, and I'm capable of doing this. So it's like the substance mattered a lot more in the middle round. And then if you fast forward that through a few more rounds, that dynamic continued. And I expected, as, you know, first-time entrepreneur, never been a CEO before, I expected by the time we got to being, you know, really late stage or public company, that it would be it would just be like a spreadsheet exercise. Right? It'd be like, all right, you want to invest, here's the spreadsheet. What do you think? You know, oh, that looks pretty good. We'll invest, we won't invest. What was interesting about it is that it turned out to much more revert to the earlier style vision and big story than I'd expected. I would say by the time we went public, when you write your S-1, which is the document you write when you go public, there's every financial number is in there that you'd ever want to know about the company. It's fully disclosed. I mean, there's no secret about financials or growth rate or risks or all the stuff for the investors. So you'd think like that would be it, right? You'd take this S-1 and then that they would decide to invest or not. But what happens is you spend a ton of time in the S-1 actually on the vision. What is the long-term vision? How do you take this company? How is this company going to be whatever it's worth at IPO? How is it going to be worth 10 times that? And that felt to me a lot like the very early days, like the seed round, which is where we would go back and they're like, yeah, just paint a big picture, tell me what this is like, which kind of surprised me. I just had this idea that, you know, the IPO would be much more super substantive and like all about financial return and not about this big picture story stuff that felt, you know, a little bit more squishy to me.
It's interesting because that is often the sort of knock on the public markets that investors don't want a grand vision. They just want people to stick to a plan.
Yeah, I think the answer is both, right? Mm-hmm. Every investor I've talked to, almost to a T, has been very interested in long-term, and of course it's a little bit self-fulfilling because we somewhat pick which investors we talk to, not totally, but you have some control over the investors you meet with directly. But it's, they're very interested in these long-term, this long-term direction of your company, and how do you fit in with the landscape and the technology trends, and how are you going to be successful ultimately?
So that's happened during the roadshow beforehand, and it's continued now?
Yeah, it's really continued, and I think it's probably, we have been fortunate enough that we've delivered good results, and the stock price has, as you mentioned, appreciated. And I think that's related because as the price gets higher, they kind of need more help understanding where it goes from here, because they're thinking about obviously buying it and having to go up even further.
How to make that pie bigger. So I want to transition over to just, again, we're talking about scaling up your life as an entrepreneur and really sort of day to day and how that changed from being, starting a company and now running a huge company.
Yeah.
Can we just talk a little bit about sort of like your week?
Yeah.
How you've changed those, think short and long term.
Yeah, I think that I think there's different styles as a CEO. I'm pretty, in terms of the areas of the company I spend my focus on, I'm pretty balanced. Some CEOs will drill into one area, they'll be very sales-centric or very customer-centric or very product-centric. I try to be fairly balanced in terms of how I spend my time. I spend a significant amount of my time in one-on-ones with my direct reports, talking through things and trying to help them figure out what's going on in their organization and so forth. I spend a bunch of time with customers. I think I probably spend more time on product and engineering. It's not totally balanced. That's my background, and I'm super excited about that area and what we're doing there. I think how it's changed is, I went from, when I was at Salesforce, I had, about 300 people working for me. It was, pretty frenetic, busy job. A lot of work, obviously in the engineering team at Salesforce, but coordinating with different parts of the companies, and then different parts of the company. And I remember when I started Okta, it was like, I remember I had my last day at Salesforce. I turned in my BlackBerry. We had BlackBerries. I went to Verizon and bought my own personal BlackBerry. You can tell how long ago it was. And it was like crickets chirping. I was like, there's like no assistant. There's no, like, no one's calling me. It's like, I thought I mattered. I thought I was a player. Turns out I wasn't. And you kind of have to get it going. In the first few years of your own company, I'm sure some of you are probably in this mode now, which is, it's like, you're doing everything. And it's like, you're doing the recruiting, your marketing, your engineering, you're hiring every person you talk to. Every person, you got to, like, really, really pour your heart and soul into recruiting them to join the team. It's like, why would I even join this silly company? What are you guys even doing? It's like, here, look at the product. It's going to be big. You're running around really frenetically. And then it isn't until you have about, I would say, like a couple hundred people, where you actually have someone in every job in the company. What I mean by that is, by the time you have 200 people, you probably have like someone running HR, someone running, maybe have a CFO, or at least a VP of finance. You have marketing. And at that time, the job starts to change, where the being frenetic and running around and doing everything starts to be less of the responsibility, and more of the responsibility becomes like big picture leadership. And the way I describe it now is, a big part of the way I try to orient myself is, I basically have to make 5 or 6 key decisions every year with a high hit rate of success. Like, whether that's the right leader to hire or the right market to enter or the right, very big picture decisions. And whatever I need to do to equip myself to make those decisions effectively is how I try to think about organizing my time. So when I visit with customers, I try to make sure that it's the right kind of customers that are giving me the right context to make product or strategy decisions. It's when I meet with investors, it's like, how are we positioning the company from an investor perspective? What's going to work there? What's not? So I would say it doesn't feel as busy. It doesn't feel as like frenetic and 24/7. But it still can be stressful, and it's like the day-to-day work maybe less, but the impact of the decisions is bigger. So it's still high stakes.
Are there any, would you have a tip or two? I mean, you talk about the five or six things, but also, you know, you're having to think super long-term, as you said, to investors, just to the vision of the company. Is there any time you set aside? Is there any sort of rhythm to your weeks where you take the time out to think about these, like the longer-term vision to make sure you're not?
I think this is probably just me personally, but I'm pretty, I can kind of think about things big picture. I don't need time set aside for it specifically. Maybe that just means I zone out all the time and do it all the time. But yeah, I feel like whether it's just, you know, you always have some downtime in your day to think, it seems like. But I don't need to set stuff aside. It's like getting more of the context and like, you know, meeting with more people and thinking about reading more things kind of helps me get fresh on the ideas. So. I do think it is, one tip I would share is that I think people make the mistake a lot of times of worrying about the medium-term planning, like what are things going to be like in 3 years or 2 years. It's like, I think thinking about that time frame is probably not productive. I think people should think about really long-term, like directionally, where are you going? Like, are you going this way or are you going that way, right? I wouldn't worry about like, you know, refining it. It's like, are you going big picture, where are you going? And then the rest of your energy, you gotta get that right. You don't wanna mess that up. But a lot of your energy after that, all of your energy after that should be spent on what can I do in the next days, weeks, and months, and how can I execute on that? Especially as a startup, because the thing about startups is that you're probably gonna fail, and you just gotta get comfortable with that. And it sucks, and it's hard, but you just gotta get comfortable with that, and you gotta pick a direction, and you gotta go, and you gotta execute. Because, you know, way more startups die from, you know, and this is not just startups, way more change or innovation or growth ideas die from lack of execution than some small miss in the planning process.
Well, Todd, thank you so much for the great conversation. Thank you all for listening.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Thanks for being with us today on Jeanette's TV. I'm your host, Jeanette Burke, signing off. Please remember to like, comment, and share all our posts with your family and friends. You will find us on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Pinterest, Vimeo, YouTube, you name it, we're there. Hashtag Jeanette's TV. And until next time, continue to be fabulous.